Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carrie St. Pei of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program near New Orleans, who discusses the long-term environmental impact of British Petroleum's massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Alan Charney with the Coalition Americans for Financial Reform, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of proposed finance reform legislation now being debated in Congress. And Paul Scott, author of the article, Is Your Life on the Line?, who talks about his investigation into the potential health hazards of cell phone use. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Honduran labor leader Vanessa Zepeda was kidnapped and later killed in the capital city of Tegucigalpa after leaving a union meeting in early February, adding to the growing number of opposition leaders that have been killed this year. According to the news magazine In These Times, Zepeda was an active member of the National Front for Popular Resistance, which has refused to recognize the military-backed government of President Porfirio Pepe Lobo, who was elected in January. Zepeda disappeared right after a meeting at the Bottling Plant Union Hall to discuss devising a joint labor strategy to fight President Lobo. Since the military coup last June that deposed President Manuel Zelaya, over 40 members of the resistance have been killed, half of them labor activists. Gilda Batista of the Honduran human rights group Refuge Without Limits observed that the killing of activists sends a message to the resistance that union members will be murdered if they meddle in the political arena. 7 Honduran journalists have also been killed in recent weeks. Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky has called for the U.S. State Department to investigate the growing wave of killings and to delay recognition of the Lobo government unless the violence ceases. The Nation magazine reports that a deep layer of corruption has tainted the supply network for U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. The corrupt enterprise involves 2 fuel contracting companies, Red Star Enterprises and MENA Corporation, which were awarded no-bid fuel contracts at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and Manas Air Base in Kyrgyzstan. The companies are controlled by retired U.S. Army officer Chuck Squires, who in the late 1990s worked as defense attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. After the 9/11 terror attacks, the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan gained military strategic importance for the U.S. and NATO-led war in Afghanistan. Red Star had strong connections with the Kyrgyz president, Askar Akayev. When the little-known company won the fuel contract, President Akayev's family received millions of dollars in subcontracts with Red Star. In 2005, Akayev was removed from office by massive street protests known as the Tulip Revolution. The new president, Kermanbek Bakiev, claimed to be a reformer but engaged in the same type of corrupt practices as Akayev. The fuel contracts were overseen by the president's son, Maxim. Officials in the new interim government in Kyrgyzstan, who replaced Bakiev after his government was overthrown in April, says Red Star was paying off Bakiev's son. Adil Brasilov, the new government's chief of staff, accused the U.S. government under Bush and Obama of essentially bribing the Kyrgyz ruling family. First it was Akayev, and then it was Bakiev. Chevron has filed a federal lawsuit against documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger. His 2009 film Crude explores a $27 billion lawsuit against the energy giant for oil pollution in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Chevron wants access to 600 hours of uncut footage left out of the movie. Berlinger is fighting the motion, saying it is a violation of his right to free speech and compares the uncut footage to a reporter's unpublished notes. Chevron insists uncut footage would help explain events relating to the class action lawsuit now being heard in Lago Agrio, Ecuador. Berlinger insists Chevron's motion would violate confidentiality agreements he made with indigenous Ecuadorians and employees of Chevron. The filmmaker says these agreements were required to gain the trust of key subjects in the documentary. Berlinger concluded, "If Chevron is successful in getting a journalist to turn over a work in progress, it would have a chilling effect on this kind of documentary making in the future." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As the British Petroleum drilling rig spill continues to release nearly 5,000 barrels of crude oil a day, wreaking havoc in the Gulf of Mexico, frantic efforts are underway to contain it. 30% of U.S. domestic oil comes from the Gulf of Mexico, most of it from deepwater wells, now that the oil closer to shore has mostly been depleted. The offshore oil and gas industry employs 35,000 workers. Evidence is mounting that BP cut corners to continue production instead of addressing emerging safety issues. Though redundancy was supposed to be built into the system to guard against accidents, British Petroleum apparently chose not to install a deep water valve that could have sealed leaks in case of an accident. The area is also rich in natural gas, and one likely explanation for the explosion that claimed the lives of 11 workers on April 20th is that gas leaked into the concrete seal that Halliburton installed to encase the well in deep water. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kerry St. Pei, executive director of the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary Program, covering the productive and fragile wetlands west of New Orleans. Pei previously worked for more than two decades as chief spill preventer in that region. He spoke by cell phone from the Incident Command Center in Houma, Louisiana, where he was assisting in the joint state-federal response to the disaster.
The absolute worst-case scenario is that this thing is spewing out oil at the rate of 5,000 barrels a day for 90 days. That's the time it would take them to drill a relief well. Oil would be pushed and moved around the Gulf in all directions in accordance with the wind and the currents. It's highly probable that oil would then impact and go inside in the internal estuaries into the Barataria Basin and to the Terrebonne Basin. These are very sensitive areas. That's the nursery grounds. That's where everything begins. All the marine resources, all the birds, everything is in abundance within the estuary. And that would be by far the worst case scenario.
People don't know how bad it's going to get, but do people there consider this a watershed moment, so to speak? I know it's a jobs issue, but maybe there could be other kinds of jobs without this kind of risk to both humans and the environment. And maybe we need to move away from fossil fuels. Is anybody talking about that?
Oh, people are talking about, potential environmental impacts. People are very angry. The fishermen are all angry because a large part of the affected area has been shut down from even fishing. All the boats are tied up in harbors. But, you know, there's questions as to how much safeguards were put in place by this drilling company. That's where the concern is right now. Nobody down here is talking about stopping the offshore drilling or production of oil and gas. People, unfortunately, do need oil and gas, for everything they do in life, powering, their cars, for example. But no one's saying that we shouldn't try to find a alternative fuel. But in the meantime, what are you going to do?
I wonder, just because the Cape Wind project was just approved off Nantucket in the North Atlantic, and it seems like similar conditions might be prevalent offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, is anyone there talking about developing a wind industry?
Yeah, people are talking about wind energy, but that won't replace oil and gas. What this event probably will do, most assuredly, it's going to import more safeguards, even more redundant safeguards than what were required prior to this.
Kerry St. Pei, do you hear a lot of people talking about just leaving the area, that this is kind of the last straw?
Well, I haven't heard talk about, regarding people moving. The people that fish married, so to speak, to the place. Fishing anywhere else in the United States, certainly not internal United States. So I wouldn't, foresee a lot of people moving out because of this incident. But I have seen a lot of anger. People, very confused and just angry that they're losing their livelihood and, wanting to do something, wanting to respond with placing booms out and caused a kind of a frenzy down here. People, sometimes making some incredible accusations and are just really confused as to what can be done and what can't be done in cleaning up the soil. For instance, boom placement. There's people saying that the company isn't putting out enough boom. Well, the weather has been so bad down here that they can't even get the boom deployed. It's unsafe, plus the winds and seas are blowing the boom far onto land, so they aren't doing any good. And it's useless to place boom when it's not doing any good, when it's not even in the water. So things like that, the people that do this for a living do know what they're doing. And they're not putting boom out during rough seas because they're completely ineffective. So, just fishermen see that and they are understandably angry, but not justifiably angry.
That was Carrie St. Pay, head of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program in the Louisiana Bayou. Call the program at area code 985-447-0868 or visit the group's website at btnep.org. As Congress enters into final debate on the shape of legislation to reform federal financial regulations, thousands of protesters descended on Wall Street on April 29th to lay blame on the nation's big banks for the collapse of the U.S. economy. Before a rally on Wall Street, union members, activists, and the unemployed marched to the offices of J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo, where they demanded a meeting with the bank's CEOs. The action was part of the AFL-CIO's Make Wall Street Pay campaign, which is demanding Congress impose a transaction tax on the trading of securities that would fund a $900 billion government jobs program. While the House passed a financial reform bill in December, the Senate has begun final debate on their version after overcoming a Republican attempt to block work on the bill with a filibuster. The House bill, the most far-reaching reforms of bank regulation since the Great Depression, calls for the regulation of some derivatives and creates a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, as well as demanding the largest banks and investment firms hold more funds in reserve. The legislation also requires banks to pay as much as $150 billion into an emergency fund to bail out troubled institutions or break them up. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Alan Charney, Strategy and Policy Director with the group U.S. Action, a partner of Americans for Financial Reform, a coalition of more than 200 labor and consumer groups. Charney looks at the strengths and weaknesses of congressional financial reform bills and explains what progressive activists want in the final legislation to ensure an accountable, fair, and secure financial system.
The bill that passed the House and the bill that's in front of the Senate institutes several new regulations which will protect consumers and will make it much less likely that a crisis like this happens again. However, what the bills don't do is they don't change the overall size of the financial sector and the economy as a whole, and they don't change the whole nature of how so much of our economic growth is driven by bubbles and speculation and not by productivity and real wage growth and income growth for the majority of people. So they go far. But given the political reality, at this point in time, we can't achieve everything we want to. I mean, I'll talk about some of the good things in the bill, and that's why we're supporting it. It has a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which for the first time would provide a broad, unified federal regulation for a lot of financial products. It would regulate the derivatives market. Derivatives are those financial instruments that caused a lot of the crisis, and that created all the interconnectedness between the institutions and basically in a situation where there was no option but to step in and temporarily bail out the big banks. In the legislation, there would be an orderly system for resolving and putting to sleep financial institutions, which clearly were insolvent. So we wouldn't have the chaotic system that we had with Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. And we would have an orderly process that the financial institutions themselves would have to pay for, so the taxpayer would be protected in the future. Those are some of the strong features of the bill. There are amendments that are being offered by more progressive senators, from Sherrod Brown from Ohio, for example, that would take steps to actually limit the size of the biggest banks, essentially break them up. There's a measure that would require that the big banks basically not trade in derivatives if they wanted to maintain their status as banks with the Federal Reserve. And this, too, would go a long way toward limiting the power and the instability of these banks in the future. But we're not sure if those measures will pass the Senate.
Alan, could you address for us the issue of the credit rating agencies like Moody's that were implicated in being paid by these big financial institutions and artificially rating their products, giving their products really high ratings that they didn't deserve in terms of some of these subprime mortgages that were being sold and bundled around the world? It seems like that's an essential flaw in the system.
It's a huge flaw, and unfortunately, here's another area where the current legislation doesn't go far enough. We have a position in AFR where we actually say that the federal government should create its own rating agency that would compete with the private agencies. That would be the best way to hold those private agencies accountable, by having a public rating agency that would not be under the same kind of influence. But again, as I said before, there are a lot of good things in what was passed in the House and what's coming through the Senate, but unfortunately, the rating agency provisions are not strong enough.
Alan Charney, from all accounts, lobbyists from Wall Street and banking firms all over the country have descended on Capitol Hill to weaken financial reform legislation. And groups like yours, of course, are countering the lobbyists. But how can citizens get involved in this fight? And what would you advise them to do that would be most effective in getting the message out that I believe a good part of the country believes in, that these financial regulations need to be as strong as possible? The congressman should not capitulate to the lobbyists and the banks with so much money to give candidates for their reelection campaigns.
It's grassroots voices that are really needed. Right now, the voice of all citizens is crucial in this fight, because we're outgunned inside the Beltway, and the only way we're going to win and win strongly is by the voices of thousands upon thousands of people outside the Beltway. So it really, people, the most important thing you can do is put calls in right now, the single most important thing to do, because a lot of senators are just making up their minds about which way they're going to vote. And when the pressure is strong on our side, it will help sway their decision.
That was Alan Charney, Strategy and Policy Director with the group U.S. Action, a partner of Americans for Financial Reform. Contact the AFR at area code 202-263-4533 or visit their website at ourfinancialsecurity.org. Hundreds of millions of people across America and the rest of the world use cell phones on a daily basis. In the United States alone, there are currently 277 million cell phone accounts. With wireless phones now the primary way in which people communicate around the globe, questions about the safety of cell phones is an issue with potentially far-reaching consequences, both for the people who use them and the companies that profit from their sale. Men's Health magazine contributor Paul Scott investigated the potential health hazards of cell phones in a recent article titled, "Is Your Life on the Line?" In researching the article, the author found that contradictory research created an ambiguous picture of the true hazards of cell phone use. For example, the American Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the World Health Organization all regard the radio waves emitted from cell phones as safe. But another growing body of experts believes cell phone use can promote tumors, and momentum has been shifting to their side. Disturbingly, Paul Scott concluded that studies showing that cell phones are safe tend to be less rigorously designed and funded by the cell phone industry, while studies showing that cell phones carry risks are produced with better science and have no financial conflicts of interest. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Paul Scott, who talks about his investigation into the potential health hazards of cell phone use.
If you had to divide the research into two blocks, there's a camp out of Sweden led by an oncologist named Lennart Hardell. And since about 1999, he's produced quite a few papers based on probably five different actual studies. And he has found variously that cell phones can double your risk of getting some form of brain or head tumor after 10 years of regular use. His most recent paper was probably the one that was the most alarming, because he actually looked at people who started using cell phones under the age of 20, and they faced 4 to 5 times the risk of getting some forms of brain cancer, and they actually only needed to have used the cell phones for a minimum period of a year. So that is one block of research, and they are, it should be said, not in the mainstream. The mainstream would be all the interphone studies that was funded by the World Health Organization, and it's actually 13 different studies at this point. And they have consistently found no association between the use of cell phones for under 10 years and brain cancer, although, as curious finding, and this is what Lloyd Morgan pointed out, they found that statistically cell phones protect you from brain cancer, which no one involved in this debate argues could possibly be the case, that cell phones could magically protect you from brain tumors. So that suggests there's some sort of a problem in how those studies were conducted. I can think of one study out of the United States in all this time that was published in 2001. NIH researcher, I believe, and he found no association. But another problem with that study and the interphone studies are they described you as a regular user of cell phones if you had used them once a week. The picture of a study on smoking and lung cancer that said, let's see if, you know, regular heavy smoking gives you lung cancer, and then they included people who just smoked once a week. You could see how decisions like that and how you construct a study can affect the outcome. I don't think anyone's suggesting, you know, these decisions were made from some ill intent. No one's in a position to say anything like that, but they can at least say that that doesn't seem like a good way to set up a study. So, yeah, that's the gist of it, is that we're very confident that in our country, when you talk to the health authorities, that cell phones are, that there's no risk, but at the same time, they'll say, we don't know very much about safety of cell phones for more than 10 years, and this is generally a cancer that can take 20 to 30, even 40 years to show up from exposure. So you have to ask, what is the comfort in that statement as well?
Well, Paul, you recount a discussion you had with a friend that talked about how cell phone radio frequency radiation should really be no more hazardous than holding a flashlight up to your head. But what did you find out in the course of your investigation here about potential hazards of the radio frequencies coming out of these cell phones in terms of their effect, especially on human DNA?
Yeah. Well, the first thing you'll be told is that, you know, radio frequency, the radio waves, you know, emitted from, you know, your cell phone as it's trying to talk to a the tower is not strong enough by any stretch of the imagination to do what the radiation from CT scans can do, which is to knock electrons off of atoms and therefore, you know, damage DNA, triggering cancer. So that is often the first thing put out there, that, you know, this couldn't possibly be cancer-causing. It's non-ionizing radiation. But there's two problems with that. There's a host of cancers. We don't know the mechanism for how they function. So not having a mechanism is in itself a reason to discount the possibility. But they've also developed quite a number of basic science lab studies, primarily using rats, where they've found that radio frequency radiation can cause all sorts of indirect damage. It can cause what's called double strand breaks in DNA, and they presume through indirect means. And those could be by creating more free radicals. There's a kind of a complicated chemical exchange that's called the Fenton reaction, and that could create free radicals, which then can damage DNA. There's a science that suggests radio frequency radiation in the blood-brain barrier. These things called heat shock proteins are created, which is believed to be a sign of, you know, cellular stress. These different sort of basic science things have all been developed here and there in small little experiments, and they really weren't collected in one place until 2007, when a scientist sort of administrator out in California named Cindy Sage put together something called the Bioinitiative Report, which anybody could, you know, Google and find online. And it has all in one place all the research that could, you know, depict a mechanism for how something like a radio wave could cause problems in your cellular structure. The critics will tell you that a lot of these studies weren't always replicated very easily. They did it once and it worked, and they did it again and it didn't work. So that's a legitimate sort of retort to that. But it's not enough, it seems, to say that it's non-ionizing radiation, therefore it has no possibility of causing any tumor development, it would seem.
That was Men's Health magazine contributor Paul Scott. Read his article, Is Your Life on the Line?, about the potential health hazards of cell phone use at menshealth.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.